Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the chiclet that made us who we are. My name is Karen O'Donoghue, and I'm an author, a journalist, and a lumpy blue sweater. Joining me is author, podcaster, and perfectly placed Hermes scarf, Lindsay Kelk. Today we're talking about Lauren Weisberger's The Devil Wears Prada.
We are.
So what made you choose this book?
There were lots of reasons. It is a book that I identify really closely with in a career path way. It's one of the first books I read after I finished my degree and didn't read anything for some time. And
did you do an English degree?
Yes.
So it was years of Brontes and Eliot. Yeah. And then you're like, just rinse my brain with soap and foam.
Yeah. I did 2 years of just be like, I'll pick up the Da Vinci Code and then throwing it across the room and go, this is tosh. But just not wanting to read anything of any substance.
Yeah.
And then Devil Wears Prada. My mom gave me Devil Wears Prada and it was like, oh my God, I can enjoy reading again.
Yeah.
And also it's iconic. I feel like it's become iconic and bigger than it is.
Totally.
Even.
I mean, the thing I find difficult with this book is that it is one of the few books that people will readily say the movie is better.
Yes.
And that is, it's partly a failing of the book because I think it was a debut. You do see the saggy bits that could have used a more diligent editor.
Yeah.
I think Lauren Weisberger is a much better writer now. But also, the film has fucking Meryl Streep in it.
The film is amazing. And I hands down love the film.
Yeah.
The movie.
It's a perfect film.
Yeah. The book is just something, it's different. It's totally different. And I'd forgotten.
Totally different.
Well, it's really different. I thought tonally and character developmentally. When I reread this, I was like, oh my God, I erased so much of the plot line of the book.
Yeah, definitely. I had a similar interaction with the book to you in that I think it was definitely, it was like late teens or early 20s, like 19, 20 when I read it. And I didn't love it at the time, but now, weirdly, I love it a lot coming back to it as someone who's almost 30 because I recognize the naivety of how I was when I was 22 and I came, or I was 21 when I moved to London from Ireland, and how like Andy I was, and how I have just enough distance from that person to find that endearing now.
Yes.
But I think if you're the same age as Andy, you find her behavior frustrating, you find her frustrating, you find the whole situation frustrating. But now I see just how, like, even that thing of like, I'm just going to do this for a year and then I'm going to work at the New Yorker.
It's like, you massive knob.
I know.
As if you're
the entitlement.
Ticket. Yeah, I'm so glad that we're on exactly the same page.
Yeah.
It's scary, isn't it? And yeah, I was similar. I read it when I was about 23, maybe 24. I read it when it came out in paperback here. And I had just started working in publishing. I was an editorial assistant at HarperCollins in the children's team. And I'd previous to that, straight out of uni, spent 2 years working in PR for people that can only be described as would make Miranda Priestley look like your nan. Right. I just had two bosses straight out the gate that were actual monsters.
Right.
Two, and there are witnesses, and like in the parlance of 2019, I have the receipts. These women were evil. Like, they were dark.
Okay.
And my mom gave me the book then because she was like, oh, it reminds me of the stories you've told me about work. As though that was hilarious that her only daughter was sat in a toilet crying every lunchtime because she'd been sent out to Brighton to get nipple cream for a woman who worked in London, but they only made it at this herbal shop in Brighton. So I was like, well, okay, I'll read it. And when I read it then, I was like, oh, poor Andy, poor Andy, poor Andy. And now when I read it, I think, I had something of a chip on my shoulder,
right?
too.
And as well, I think as well, both the film and season one of the show Girls became things I watched on repeat. They were like, I had this tiny hard drive on my old laptop when I first moved to London, but those were the two things on it, Devil Wears Prada and season one of Girls, because I needed to feel like I was on a path that other women had done.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
That thing of being the least important person at a company, of being the person who does all these really demeaning errands that both are beneath you, but also you can't get right.
Yeah, you've got to do it. No, and that was me exactly. I grew up in a mining village in South Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. Really tiny school. I was kind of, I'm not shitting on the kids I went to school with, but no one really had any interest in education or going to uni or leaving the village. You didn't leave the village.
Right.
And I always wanted to. And I had a massive chip on my shoulder. I went from being the smartest kid in the school, and not just in my year, but like 4 years.
Yeah.
Just because I'd actually like got the attention of the teachers and tried quite hard, whereas that was not the cool or done thing.
Sure.
So they had obviously also spent 7 years telling me how great I was and how smart I was. Went off to uni, was drunk for 3 years. That was great.
Yeah.
But then I wandered into my first job. I'm like, why is no one kissing my ass? Why is nobody telling me? Why am I in charge of the envelope drawer? And same, like, why can't I work
why
out the
I
correct number of envelopes she needs?
That's the thing. There's nothing worse in the world than being like, this is a stupid job.
Yeah.
And I've just been to university and I've got a good degree. And da-da-da.
I've read so many books.
But,
and she's taken me in the meeting room to scream at me and everyone can hear. And I'm being screamed at because I didn't arrange the biscuits correctly on the biscuit
but
plate.
Also I deserve it because I can't even get this thing right. Like I remember having to hole punch a big stack of documents and not getting that right.
Yeah.
Like the holes being slightly off center so that when you strung it through like a punch thing that it wasn't lining up, and they were like, you fucked that, you need to go print, get that, go down to the printers, get those printed again and do that. And then being like, well, that just cost us 40 quid.
Yeah.
And it being like, you don't make me do this, but also I can't even do this tiny thing.
Yeah, that was me and the biscuit plate every day. And I'm just like, why didn't you have them show you how to do the biscuit plate one more time? Instead of just going like, it's just biscuits. I'll make up my own pattern for the biscuit plate. And in hindsight now, I'm just like, oh, what a knob.
And
I would have hated
something,
you.
Something that comes up in the book a lot is that, and I wrote down a quote in pen here, so I was dedicated.
That's how you know it's real.
Andy is on one of her many errands for Miranda that she barely understands. It's quite near the front of the book. And she says, it's better to do something wrong and spend untold dollars on fixing it than to ask for clarification.
Yeah,
and
that's not true.
No, that's not true.
It's never true.
Right? And the thing is that you get the sense that if she had really been quite straightforward and like if she hadn't been so hesitant, if she hadn't been so like in fear, if she hadn't been coached by all these women around her, the Emilys and all these people, to be so terrified of Miranda Priestley, she's been like, hey, that's not very clear.
Yeah.
Can you please explain to me that Miranda would be either A, respected it, or B, booted her.
Yeah, exactly.
And she would be doing something else. Do you know what I mean?
Is that not a better situation?
Yeah.
Exactly. I exactly agree. Every time I read it, and I'd forgotten how much of the book is just this endless cycle of her being sent out on errands and messing it up.
Yeah.
And going out on errands and just fucking it up and going to get steak and then binning it. Every time she binned food, I'm like, eat the food.
Stop
complaining about how skinny you've got and eat some dinner.
Right.
I lived in New York. There's food everywhere.
Yeah.
It's everywhere. that really annoyed me.
What's interesting is that there is this, I mean, it is kind of a realistic novel about a fashion magazine in that the thing around size and weight is quite disgusting and uncomfortable to read about, but also disgusting and uncomfortable to live through. And people do live like that.
Yeah.
We've all met them. I've lived in London long enough to meet them. I'm sure you lived in
New York.
One of
my bosses in the PR company put me on Atkins when I was 22 because she told me when I came in for my interview, she had looked through the window and told the girl that hired me that she couldn't hire me because I was too fat and ugly to work in PR.
Wow.
This was like 2003. She told me this drunk because she was actually an alcoholic, I later discovered. And she's laughing, thinking it's a helpful, hilarious thing to tell me. But I'm 23. And then she's like, oh, we'll just do Atkins together. We'll do it together. Which then led to 6 months of me being sent to McDonald's to fetch her bunless burgers every morning. But I wasn't supposed to do that. I had to like go and get my own Atkins approved food. And it stayed with me for so long, because I was 23 and I did not know that was relevant to my skill set.
I mean, I don't think there's any way of accessing this book without accessing your most traumatic early employment self. Like, that is what this
very
one has
touched triggering.
It is the
sense.
Horcrux of of traumatizing early employment stories. I had I was briefly an assistant for this woman who owned. I'm not going to say who she owned because it would be
illegal. She was a woman.
She was a woman and she owned her own company and good for her. Fucking lean in. I was briefly her assistant. And every day she would just look out the blinds of her window that faced onto like Holborn and just like commented on the fatness of the people who walked down the street. And she herself was one of the, just, you know, not a thin woman and constantly on some strange diet, but always some very 80s diet, like a Weight Watchers or an Atkins
diet or something like that. It was always something disgusting.
Right, something
gross. It was never just, I'm going to eat healthily and do some exercise. It's like, I'm going to be rancid for a month.
Oh,
and you're all
rancid.
Yeah.
She used to be in the office from 11 till 4 every day because those were her hours. And she would send me out every day for her lunch, which was this: a packet of smoked mackerel and a cup of miso soup from Pret a Manger. And I would just sit and watch her across, like a desk across from her, the only two people in the room, just watching her eat mackerel with her hands.
She sounds delightful.
She was fucking evil.
Oh, that is nasty. Yeah, my boss's was a venti wet latte. Mm-hmm. I had to go and get a piping hot venti wet latte, which is why Devil Wears Prada is, again, quite triggering.
Yes.
Two cheeseburgers, but no buns. And I wasn't allowed to take the buns off myself. I had to make it very clear to McDonald's in Richmond that they were to give me no bun.
No.
And it was 2003. No, Atkins was only just becoming a thing. No one understood why the sobbing 22-year-old is saying, please don't put a bun on this. She will know.
If you just take it off the bun yourself, she will know.
Yeah. And I occasionally she would accuse me of it just in case, you know? And again, hindsight, I'm like, she didn't know.
This is like a trope that is so well worn in this book of like the dragon lady who abuses the gormless assistant who's just trying her best. Why do you think that trope is both so prevalent in pop culture and also so real to life? I don't know any woman who hasn't had this specific experience with a female boss.
Yeah, I think that's why it's used so often, is it's a shortcut. Yeah, it's a really easy way to connect with, especially women, men as well, but especially women who tend to take more shit, I think, in the early days than a man might, because men aren't conditioned to take as much shit as we are. And I think it makes, I don't want to say lazy, but it's a very easy way to connect with your readers.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's really interesting about this book when you read it now is Andy is not especially likable. Mm. We talk about that word all the time now. Like, women have to be likable. Women have to be likable. It's very hard to get a book away in women's fiction with a character who isn't likable. Mm. And she's not very.
No.
She's not easy to empathize with. And no one around her is either, because she's falling down this rabbit hole but is entitled with a chip on her shoulder, being basically abused and taken advantage of in her job, but her friends aren't supporting her. They're not seeing it happen. They're not saying, you're the luckiest girl in the world. A million girls will kill for this job.
Yeah.
And they just stick to that. At no point do they say, do you know what? You seem really unhappy and I know you want to stick it out, but it might not be worth it.
Yeah.
So it's really difficult because I think I empathize with her, but I don't like her.
Yeah. Because I think in order to like Andy, you have to forgive yourself as a 22-year-old.
Yes.
And I think that's really hard for some women.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I don't think it's like, I think when people talk about likable characters, they're generally talking about one of two things. Either A, it's like a Gillian Flynn character who has like murderous instincts and like has a pure, like a strain of like violence in her that is compelling and kind of really itchy for you to sort of read.
And you're reading it with glee because you just can't stop. No, you want to know more about this.
Totally.
Person.
And you want, and she becomes a cipher for you to sort of explore kind of female violence and the way that we're not allowed to explore female violence.
Yes.
Love Gillian Flynn. Can't believe we haven't done an episode on her yet. But there's the other thing, which is like, just a little bit of a cunt.
Yeah.
Which is...
Yeah, and that's where I specialise.
Right?
In my book.
But that's the hard sell. That's actually what's harder to sell than the whole female violence.
I find it a really hard balance because I think creating a character... And it just gets harder every day. I talked about this with someone recently, one of my friends who's a writer, and I was like, we've put ourselves in a position now where... The theory is everyone's like, oh, I don't want to read any more books about adorable, quirky girls who drop their handbag and their tampon falls out because that's bullshit. But also, I don't want to read about someone who isn't likable. I want to empathize with this person. Yeah. Like, we've actually, instead of widening the goalposts, we've narrowed them again. And it's like
so
now, we have in Gone Girl, we have the cool girl trope.
Yes.
And Andy is not the cool girl. Andy is a long way away from the cool girl. But while we're saying we all hate the cool girl, the books that are getting published, there's a lot of books about the cool girl. And I just find it's really hard, I think, at the minute. I would be fascinated to read Devil Wears Prada if it came out today. Because I don't know how different it would be, but I don't think it would be considered chick lit. Because it's not. The romance storyline is kind of forced in there.
It really
tacked
is.
On. It's a woman's experience in her first year in her job. It's really hard to pull out the romance as the key to it.
Right. And even I really do feel bad for...
Adrian Grenier's character, Alex.
Alex,
I feel bad for him, but he's also a puss.
I feel bad for him because he's the only actor in that film that, like, despite being a very handsome man, like, you've got all these tour de force performances. Yeah. Stanley Tucci, Emily Blunt, Meryl Streep, Anne Hathaway. Like, and then just, like, Adrian Grenier. Oh, no one cares.
You know? You've got Entourage at the corner.
Entourage!
Yeah, I mean, bless him. But even in the book, like, I find him tedious. I'm like, no, I know you have a very important, hard job, but support your girlfriend.
Yeah.
Don't write it off just because it's a fashion magazine. How dare you?
I find their whole relationship, honestly, like, I don't, I gotta say, I like this book for the reasons that I mentioned to you a minute ago, which is that it kind of reminds me of a time period and the way I thought and felt. I don't think I like it as a book. And I think their relationship grates on me because they do have this early 20s thing where it's like, well, he's a school teacher and actually the kids know prisons better than they know.
I know. They're debating which prison is better to be in. I'm like, oh, shut up.
It's
you're
so
gonna
on the nose.
You're going to break up with him in two years anyway. Because I think it is a very accurate depiction of that post-college relationship where you try and have post-college relationship work in the real world when in reality you've just become two different people from the off. But in the book, all the blame is placed on her. That's not fair. She's not entirely responsible for this nonsense.
I think what's interesting as well, the first, so she has like her first week at Runway, and which I think is a really nice touch from a writerly perspective of the first week she spends at Runway is Miranda's not around.
Yeah.
So we get these like phone-ins from Miranda, but it's mostly kind of low-key in that she's wrapping gifts and sending them. And there's this fantastic bit where she says to Emily, and it's the first time they actually have anything to do with one another, where they're like they see each other as humans, where she says, how much do you think this costs? Yeah. And Emily says, oh, I think, $12,000 for all the champagne. And she said, no, how much does this cost? As in, what's the FedEx? What's the packaging? What's this? And she's like, oh, well, this is how much the shipping costs. And this is how much our labor costs, which is like the last 6 days of us being here. And then realizing that the least expensive thing on this long list is their time and labor.
Yeah.
And that is so... so true to the incredibly demeaning experience of being a low-income person at a very high capital place.
And just shows you what a tiny cog you are in the wheel. It's such a brilliant way of writing it to show you without saying you mean less than this bottle of champagne, but it's saying like you mean less.
Anyway, she goes to her first dinner with friends afterwards and or her family possibly and explaining what she got up to, and then and I think we've all had this, especially if we've worked in PR or media or publishing, of like these things that seem crucially important in life or death when you're in the office and you start relaying them to people outside the office and they just seem so silly and people are glazed over and no one understands how important these things are.
Yeah.
And you're both disgusted with yourself and like amused by yourself by this. But eventually Andy gets to this point where she's like, oh, people don't get it. You don't get how important this is, you know?
Yeah, and I find that, exactly that. It was one of those, that's one of the things that drew me to it when I very first read it. My first job as a PR was half PR and half product development for the company that made Groovy Chick stuff.
Bang on the door?
Bang on the door.
No.
It was their licensor, it was the people that ran the licensing. So I am sat in the toilets crying every lunchtime because it was a super fun environment that's been taken to court several times, so I won't go into
really?
It. But they were taken to court many times for unfair dismissals and staff treatment. It's a matter of court record, so I shan't touch it. I was never involved. But I would be sat in the toilets crying, and then I would have to go home for the weekend and explain to my parents that my job was like putting a cartoon character on a lunchbox. And this was sending me like the madhouse. Like I was like, I really feel like I'm not well.
Wow.
And they would be like, but you put a cartoon character on a lunchbox. And I can still to this day like tell you the Pantone references.
But even now, do you get the point where like, I feel like women, in, especially women in with jobs like that. Mm-hmm. And even now, like I'm a full-time author and I'm so lucky to be in that position. But even now, I still feel that slight sense of like when my partner comes home from work and he's like, well, I had two meetings with these people and three meetings with people and then I did this. And I'm like, I made up some people who then kissed.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. And I find myself diminishing it constantly. I'm forever saying to people like, oh, it's just rom-com, just women's fiction.
Yeah.
And I'm trying really hard not to because what we do is really hard. Again, even now I feel bad saying it, but I know I work really hard.
And like another thing I really love about it as well is the I think my favorite parts of the book are definitely the earlier stages when she's just getting into it and interviewing and she just meets Miranda and she seems fine.
Yeah.
And like, but there's this fantastic bit where she goes for a series of interviews at Runway. She meets various members of the team. She's kind of escalated. She seems to keep meeting people and then she keeps getting escalated up the chain. She eventually meets Miranda, which is very true to life of how interviews actually go. And actually, I don't really think I've seen interviews done this well in a book before. Because generally, whenever it's done dramatically for anything, books, films, TV, it's like, and you walk in and you're with the important person.
Yeah,
and
you're
then
not
they
meeting
ask,
that person for like 4 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to like charm several people through the ranks, many of whom you'll never see again. And you'll also be introduced, like, and this is Anna from finance. And you're like, why am I being introduced to her?
Yeah. Because you need to charm Anna from finance because she has a direct line straight to the person you're going to be working for, but you don't know because you're 22.
Exactly. And you don't realize that, like, and there's something my dad used to drill into me when I was younger, and I realized now how good advice it was, that from the minute you walk in the door, you're on the job interview.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and everyone you meet from that, from literally level 1 to level 10 is like, but yeah, so she's coasting through this sort of interview situation, and it's very clear as a reader, and also as someone who's 29, as being like, oh, clearly somebody has quit in a hurry or whatever. Clearly they need someone to fill a gap quickly.
Yeah.
And they're like, they're selling her all this mantra of like, oh, Miranda's amazing. And after a year, you'll be able to do anything you want. And she's this great person. And they all have this weird monotone that she finds slightly suspicious.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's kind of like watching a horror movie where like people are slightly off and you don't know
it's
why.
It's like Get Out quite. It's a little bit Get Out. Yeah.
It is.
Like, well, who's in your brain?
Is
it's not you. And it's like, no, Miranda's in their brain. Yeah. That's who's there.
And she doesn't have the, she's too naive and too innocent to realize she's being sold a lemon.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, because she just thinks she should take it.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
But even then, like, it drives me slightly crazy, the andiness of it, when she's trying to break Emily all the time, how she desperately wants to break Emily into confessing that she secretly hates it.
Mm.
And when I was reading that part, I'm like, leave her alone.
She has a coping mechanism.
She wants to work here. She wants this to be her career. This is how she's getting by.
Yeah.
She has to do two more years of this. You think you're helping. You're not helping. And now, you know, she's Emily Blunt in my head. So especially leave her alone.
Leave that woman alone.
Yeah, that Stanley Tucci will be her brother-in-law one day.
I know.
Don't make this difficult. I know, I love
it. It's so nice.
I love it so much. But yeah, in the book, that I found that really difficult to read when she's constantly needling at Emily. And like, it's not actually going to make you feel better. And I think there's a moment when she's helping Miranda hosts a dinner party at the Met for her brother-in-law's engagement party.
Mm-hmm.
And wants it to this big fancy affair, and Andy has to come and be an assistant, and she makes a friend who works at the Met who gives her a photo of Miranda looking sad and lonely and bad. And she's like, oh, you know, didn't think there were photos of her looking bad, ha ha ha. But she prints it out and leaves it for Andy to take home with her to feel better, to look at it, to make her feel better.
Mm.
And Andy tears it up and is like, looking at photos of her looking sad and lonely isn't going to make me feel better. And it's one of my favorite moments of self-awareness in a book that has so little. I really was like, oh, that was the moment I wish I'd had when I was in those jobs.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have it. It was only when I left those jobs and got my job in publishing and was walking around all day, no one's called me. No one's called me like the worst words. No one's told me I'm fat. No one's told me these weird things. I didn't know jobs were like this.
Oh my God.
So I was pleased for her to have that. But then it makes it more stressful when she just keeps being stupid.
That's the thing, is that these glimmers of realizations do happen, and then she's just sucked back in. But also, it's frustrating from a narrative point of view, but also very true to the life of how that actually happens.
Because
we've all been in what I would term as an abusive employment situation.
Yes.
I think like this is something I've sort of been working on in my head for a while, and I've written about it in various places. But like, we talk about emotionally abusive relationships,
mm-hmm.
and the tenets of those things are relationships that make you doubt yourself,
that consistently
manipulate your self-esteem, that financially hamper you so that you can't leave. And there's all these, like, you can go on any sort of women's refuge site and you can see all these tenets
mm-hmm.
of what an emotionally abusive. And you can, there's so many times where I've had a friend who's been crying over her job that she just won't leave, and I'll pull up that list and I'll be like, blah, 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 you're in an abusive relationship.
Yeah.
And I think we need to get better at seeing that and not being like, no, this is just what jobs are. But also, what's very true to life is that you can have these realizations over and over again, but still not have the strength to leave.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. My PR terrible boss situation was two jobs over 2 years. Mm. And I left the first one and just thought, there can't be anything worse than this. Went to the second one and it was worse.
Mm.
But because I'd left a job and I was so terrified of having two short, and one I was in 11 months and the other I stayed for the full year, but I was so scared of having two short jobs on my CV right at the beginning of my career. You're just going to have to figure it out. You're just going to have to stay. You're just going to have to make this work. And it was so much worse than the first situation, because the first situation was a bully who bullied everybody. And the second situation was someone who bullied everyone, but on a very personal, intimate, scary level.
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry you went through all this.
I mean, now I'm like, oh, well, that's fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, I made one of my best friends for life in that job, because the two of us were like,
oh, you
we're
do.
Gonna get through. Yeah. It was like the war. We were like, together, we will get through this. And we did, and we're stronger for it. But I hate the idea of like, oh, you have to do these things to be stronger for it. You don't. You do not have to stay in these situations. If I had left, there would have been a plan B.
I think you're right. I think you have to have these experiences. No, you don't have to have these experiences. You don't. However, it takes being in one of those experiences in order to understand and empathize with other people who are in them. And I think that is something that stays with you later in your career.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it helps you notice interns and assistants. And like, whenever I worked in a job where an intern came in, I've always tried to at least do the kind of, hey, if you want to go for lunch or ask me any coffee, ask me questions over coffee, I'm here, and be that person. And I think that is why you can always spot people who maybe their parents were in a position so that they didn't have to work during university, and then they went straight into quite a nice job, and then they were in a graduate program where they were escalated, and you can spot them because they're not aware of people in the office that are beneath
them. And
I
knew a lot of those in publishing. That was, and I mean, book publishing is an industry that it's changing now, but definitely I was 20, it was 15 years ago since I started in book publishing, and it was very much, oh, that's so-and-so's daughter, or you know who that is, don't you? And there was a lot of velvet headbands and a lot of Venetias, and I'm like Lindsay from the Pitt Village, and I'm just like, what am I doing here? This is the best. And but on one hand, it was great because it made me so committed to making it work, and
I
worked
same way,
so hard. And I'm not saying the other people didn't. Some did, some didn't. Because it's that interesting thing about privilege where, and Andy to an extent in the book has so much privilege because she has a family she can go back to. She has people who will help
her. Lives in Connecticut. Like she's like an hour away.
She's come from a very like comfortable background. Yeah. She's not dragging herself up by a bootstrap. She wouldn't have been welcomed through that door if she wasn't already from where she was from.
Right.
She would never have even got into Elias Clark, let alone into an interview. Yeah. And I know that about my background too. There were people that wouldn't have even got through the door that I was lucky enough to get through. Mm-hmm. But it's what you do with that opportunity when you get it.
Yeah.
And this is such an interesting example of someone who works really hard but begrudges every moment of it and resents it. And even as the narrative, as it is, starts to develop through the book, in the movie, it's obviously so much more, it's funnier and played for laughs and played for emotions. Whereas in the book, it's like you just see her turning into Miranda. Mm. You just see her. And it's not even like turning into her. It's like she just starts to understand and apologize and accept it.
Yeah.
And she starts being a Miranda apologist too. But not even in the same way as the others who just cannot allow any criticism of Miranda. I don't think she knows it's happening until Miranda says to her, oh, you remind me a lot of me.
Yeah.
And I think that's what can happen when you come in from a position of privilege to these places, because you begrudge it, you resent it, then you get used to it, and then you think you're entitled to it. Whereas if you never felt entitled to it and you were always had, you know, now we would say imposter syndrome, if you were always thinking, what am I doing here? What am I doing here? I don't deserve to be here. I think something in you won't let you switch that off, which can hamper you because it holds you back from maybe doing the best work. But that sense of entitlement where Andy just always feels like she's entitled to her success.
Yeah.
And it takes being told you resemble someone you hate.
Right. But you're right. She walks in there like that.
Yeah. And, from the off, she's just like. Ugh.
And she keeps it's the thing of
fashion.
But there's even this thing, and it was very painful to read because I remember literally saying these words as a 21-year-old, moved to London specifically to get a job in journalism. Yeah. Yeah. She says, ugh. Better than working at some trade publication, I suppose.
I know.
It's like, oh my God, the people at trade publications, it's not easy to get those jobs, and it's hard to keep them, and they do fucking amazing work.
I did a summer internship on Toy News when I was at uni.
Oh, really?
Which is a glorious time. I will have it known that everyone worked really hard.
Yeah.
And it would be like, oh, you're just like writing about toys. I'm like, yeah, but it still has to go out. You still have to go and like do all the meetings and talk to all the people and put it together. And it's like a two-man operation.
Honestly.
So really hard work.
Trade publications are the truest form of journalism in that it is like, you have to like go to a conference in Antwerp and just like sit there for 3 days and be like, okay, here's what, you know.
It's like Milk Industry Monthly. It's like, what's new in pasteurization? You make that readable and interesting. I can make Gucci, the new season Gucci, an interesting read in 15 minutes without trying. I cannot talk about what's new in oat milk, you know, and make it readable. These people work so hard. Andy's a knob.
And then I remember thinking, first coming to London and being like, oh, I guess it'd be better than working at some trade. Because I remember I was sending in my CVs to like stylist.
Yeah.
And then I would send them in, then stylist obviously never got back to me. And then to like Bella or like Take a Break. And then obviously they never got back to me. And then I eventually was like, you know what? I think I'm going to apply for a job. Actually, it's very big of me to apply for a job at a trademark because, you know, they would be lucky to have me.
Yeah, like, you'll lower yourself to a trademark.
I know. And then, of course, they never got back to me. It's like, oh, my God. The end. Again, entitlement is such a boring word.
No,
and it's a really boring phrase to, like, talk about a whole generation of people who were promised a lot and then didn't get it. But
the indignity of being 22, man. Like, it's just incomparable. I was talking to someone the other day about how when you talk about being a teenager, and why first love and YA is so appealing to so many people as books, because when you were a teenager, everything was life or death. You were feeling it all for the first time, and that's why it's so compelling now, because it reignites that in you. This book entirely reignited my indignity of being 22 that I had never felt before and have never felt since, because it was such a humbling experience to get the biscuit plate wrong on a daily basis for 11 straight months. And I just think there was no other book captured it quite as well for me as that. But yeah, man, I don't enjoy Andy. And the book is it's really hard to enjoy.
She's a fun mirror, you know?
I hate you. I hate you all. I hate you. I hate the boyfriend. I quite like the poor friend who's a raging alcoholic and you do nothing to help her.
Yeah.
And the lenient judge really needs to feel like I need a word with him.
Step his game up. Yeah.
Definitely ran a car into traffic whilst hammered, and you were just like, she didn't mean to.
She's a nice girl. It's definitely like a chronicle of the things white women get away with, this book.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, it really is.
One of the key differences between the book and the film, and as I say, they are very complicated and knotty in my head.
Yeah.
Is that in the film, she has to sort of Emily gets hit by a car or something.
She gets the flu. I think it's the flu in the... Is it the flu in the book? I can't remember. No, it is. She gets hit by the car when she's getting the scarves, isn't it?
Yes.
Because there's that amazing moment where the scarves go up flying. Which I'm always looking for in the book, and it's not there.
I know.
Yeah, and then she gets mono in the book.
So in the book, she gets hit by a car, and then... Miranda says to Andy, oh, tell Emily. And this becomes the big betrayal that she's going to go to Paris over Emily.
Yes, you're right.
And then while she's in the book, while she's there, her best friend Lily...
Is involved in a drunk driving accident that she caused.
That she caused.
Yeah. And I just feel like driving a car the wrong way down Madison Avenue whilst hammered there wouldn't be a lenient judge for that. As far as I know, I lived in New York for 6 years. I'm feeling strongly I would have seen that on New York One, and there was no leniency involved.
Yeah.
But, you know,
that's very.
She survives, which is great.
I love having just come out of my debut year, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of comfort because obviously I'm now at that stage where I hate my debut novel.
Yeah. And we all do. That.
We all do. But I love seeing other debuts and recognizing where a debut writer has just been like, well, fuck it. And then there's a car accident, I guess.
I feel like, yes, I see the editorial note that said this needs turning up at the end. Like, we need more drama at the end. And you're like, yeah, car crash.
I guess.
Smash it. Let's do it. It's what my writing tutor would have called throwing the teddy in the crash, which was his favorite narrative device, which was if it's not dramatic enough. It was a story that he told of being a young junior reporter on a local magazine newspaper, and he went to cover a car crash with the senior reporter. And when they got there, there was really no story. It was just like a really dramatic crash, but nothing had happened and everyone was fine. Mm-hmm. So the senior reporter went to the newsagents, bought like a little teddy bear, smushed it with his foot, rubbed it up, and threw it into the crash. And he was like, just take a photo of that. That's our story. And my teacher at the time was like, but there's no story. There was no kid in the car. And he was like, no, but it makes a great picture. So now we don't need more of a story. We just have this compelling photo. That's what this is in this book to me. That is Lauren Weisberger throwing the teddy in the crash. She's just like, let's throw in some drunk driving.
Totally. Because they're really, in terms of this book being like a hitting the beats that you would expect in like a hero's journey, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. She's entitled and annoying, then she's entitled and tired.
Yeah.
And then she is entitled and enjoying it, and then it's the end.
Yeah. Oh, what actually brings us on to a very fun point, which we haven't touched on yet, which is the fact that this is, by Weisberger's own admission, a very thinly disguised account of her own experience at Vogue with supposed Diana Wintour. And even there's more comparisons you can see, like Nigel is... obviously Andre Leon Talley.
Yes.
Coming in his capes and swishing around.
Who I love.
Welcome to the dollhouse.
Baby. Yeah, he might be my favorite character in the whole book.
Oh, he's fantastic. So it's interesting because as a novelist, I've spent a lot of my time saying like, oh God, why is it that like when men write things, it's invention, when women write things, it's memoir. Yes. And then the Lauren Weisberg has come along and they do thinly disguise memoir. And you're like, well, in that, you know, how do you feel about sort of
exactly
autofiction?
And I feel like the parts of the book that don't hold up as well, i.e. the Christian Collingsworth and the car crash, and they're the parts that feel the most invented. The parts that ring the most true are like the Christmas packing and the going out for errands. And you're like, oh, because you did that. You lived that. And I'm seeing your life on this page.
You can feel the reality of it. The bows. Which is countless bows.
Yeah, exactly. Fucking bows. But it's a real double-edged sword because I totally have the same thing as you. I wrote a book. My first book was I Heart New York. Which is another reason I love Devil Wears Prada. It's in New York, and I love New York.
And we should plug, actually, that the reason you're in here today is that you're in here for your new book, Heart Hawaii.
Yes.
So you've written a lot of these books. And,
I've written a lot of these books about a lot of different places, and none of it is autobiographical.
Sure.
But I Heart New York came out 10 years ago, and I moved to New York about a month after the book came out. So obviously, you know how it is with a debut author. It's not like everyone, and there was no real social media around then. No one's banging my door down to be like, is this a true story at the time? Because you're a debut author who means nothing to anyone. Let's see how it goes. And then as my future books came out and my profile raised, and I was same as you, writing for magazines, doing stuff like that, people just assumed that it was autobiographical because they know who's going back to check what date I moved to New York. They just assumed that I had written the book after I moved to New York and it was based on my reality, and it wasn't at all. It was the opposite. It was my fantasy book. It was my escapist fantasy from a miserable life. So I find it very difficult when people assume that women cannot create, even though it's our job. And Devil Wears Prada doesn't really help itself because the bits that are more invented aren't its strongest points.
Yeah.
And I think her next couple of books too did not help because they just never connected in a way that Devil Wears Prada did until The Wives, which I loved The Wives. Is her most recent
really?
Book.
I haven't read that. What is that?
Lauren Weisberger's most recent book that came out, I think, last year. In England, it was called The Wives. In America, it's called When Life Gives You Lululemons, which I can't say with a straight face.
Wow.
God bless her UK editor.
Bad title.
Yeah. And everyone's like, isn't it great? I'm like, no, absolutely not. But it's great. And Emily is one of the main characters. But 10 years on, Emily, like grown up Emily. I super recommend it. I really, really enjoyed it.
Oh, great. Well, I can't
really
wait to.
It's really fun. Yeah, it's set amongst like a Connecticut, I think it's Connecticut or like an upstate New York, like rich wivesy set.
Do you know what? Now that you say it, I can see the cover in front of me. I've seen that in lots of bookshops. Yeah, I'm going to pick that up.
It's really fun. It's like a real fun summer romp.
Yeah.
And I really loved it. But the ones in between Devil Wears Prada and The Wives were not for me.
I believe there was a Revenge Wears Prada.
Yes, I was told by someone who worked very closely to the book not to read it.
Oh, I see.
If I enjoyed the first one.
Oh dear.
Or the movie. But it did very well. She's fine.
Reminded me a lot while I was reading it of how, because obviously reminds me of myself, coming city as a young woman, of the profound whiteness of that experience.
Yes.
And
yes.
How we actually don't get that story told through a woman of color's lens.
Because
no. There's all these bits where you can so tell that her life is so entirely white.
Yeah.
From she went to Brown. Like, and I don't know anything about the American Ivy League, but you know.
You know
what I mean?
All that you need to know.
Right. And she's from Connecticut. It's so causative.
Playing Scrabble
so
with
suburban.
Her dad, her psychiatrist dad.
Right.
Like, this is a nice life.
Right.
You've had a nice life.
And then she's in the city and she asks for directions. She realizes the man who's just sold her coffee only has enough English to sell her coffee. This is a very uncomfortable line where she can't tell the difference between her two roommates.
From that moment on, they were entirely indistinguishable to me. And the dismissiveness of that line of saying, from that moment on, in this book, you will hear no more about these characters. And that makes me so uncomfortable.
Right.
Because it's not okay.
And there is a kind of a reference to... I feel bad now. I don't feel like this is my point, my fault as a reader, because she's so dismissive of the characters.
Yeah.
These two Indian girls who work a very corporate job, and they never cross paths because they both work demanding hours. They do get this, you get the sense that this is not like, And I think this is why it's such a universal book. This is not Andy's one struggle with her job. This is like happening in every apartment all over the city, all over Harlem, all over Brooklyn, all over Williamsburg, like where all these identical 20-somethings are working like 20-hour days in order to just satisfy these bosses who barely remember their names. Yeah.
Honestly, I'd love to read their version. I want Kendra's book. Yeah. What was Kendra doing? What was Kendra going through? Like poor Kendra, who was working like 18-hour days and then passing out in a room that she had to share. Like, you had your own room, Andy. Shut up.
Yeah, come on, Andy. Yeah.
She had a support system when she got there. She had a boyfriend and a best friend already in the city, you know? It's a book that I find fascinating, but I don't know if it's a book that I like to
It is fascinating, and I'm really glad that you brought it in today, because when you suggested, I was like, okay, I don't remember loving that book, but it's given me a lot to reflect on and a lot. It's like, it's a prickly book, you know?
I think it's a really fascinating book to reread now under the lens of how we perceive women and what women went through and what women have lived with for so long, that we're now reassessing all of that, because it was so written off as fluffy chiclet. Like, it was eviscerated in the New York Times. They destroyed it. They said it made, I read the review yesterday, it made the Nanny Diaries look like it was written by the Bronte sisters. That's what the New York Times said about it.
Wow.
And it's been elevated so high, partly because of the film and because the film came out very close to the book. It was only a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I think it's been elevated.
And because it was Anna Wintour.
And Anna Wintour, and elevated and sustained. And I wonder how it would have stood up through time without the film. And how it would have been considered, because it did come out in, you know, the heat of the Marion Keys and the Sophie Kinsella and that first big chiclet boom. Yeah. So it got lumped in with it, even though, I mean, it's a terrible thing to say. I don't mean lumped in that any of that was derogatory, because they're all fantastic books by fantastic writers. But it doesn't sit necessarily closely with...
No, because there's no real romance.
It doesn't sit with a shopaholic.
No.
It doesn't sit with shopaholic at all. I would love to see how it would have lived past its publication if the film had never happened.
Do you know what I think as well? I think the film as well had such a long life over and over. Obviously, it's a great film. It's really well scripted. It's really funny. The performances are fantastic.
Yeah.
But I think it has a cult status now.
Yes, yeah.
Because it was released in 2006. 2008, we had the recession.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... there was such a global thing of these of overeducated people who now have nothing to do with that thing, and that, and also watching it in a post-recession landscape, which I used to do, you did have the real sense that Andy cannot quit this job, because there is not any more jobs. She is lucky. A million girls would kill for this. I think, interestingly, reading it in a 2002 context, which is when it came out, I think, it's very like, oh, she just thinks that an opportunity like this won't come along again because people are telling her. But it will. But if you read it in a post-recession context,
it really won't.
Like.
Yeah. And I think the thing the film does so well that I don't get from the book, in the book she's so derisive of the designers, even though she comes to know so much about them and becomes quite sneering of like, oh, as if I'd wear that with that. Like, oh, I would like, this looks great with my Prada boots and my, you know, Gucci jacket, blah, blah, blah. It never feels glamorous. It never feels enjoyable. Whereas the film is just dripping in glamour.
But very naughty glamour.
Yeah, oh my God. There's
the blazer.
And the double Chanel strand of pearls and the high boots, and when she walks out to hail the cab, and it does the cut of the montage of all the outfits
suddenly
that she wears.
Suddenly she sees.
It's glorious. But I just think that's what the film did so well. They turned it so that you were with her looking in the mirror and saying like, oh my God, actually, this is amazing. I love having these lovely things. I love giving my friend the Marc Jacobs handbag. I love giving my boyfriend a new phone. Whereas in the book, it's so trying. She's dragging you along with her.
She is.
Instead of you riding this roller coaster of like, look at this fabulous, glamorous life that is hard work. But what? Look at it. It's great to watch.
And do you know what? I think as well, what sucks is I wish Sophie Kinsella wrote this book.
Yeah.
Because there's such comic potential that in the writing never really gets hit.
No, it's not. I don't think it's funny at all. I don't find it even slightly, as you might have learned from how I've spoken about it so far.
But it could be.
I love to write comedy and it's not.
There's all these situations that are in themselves comic, but because the writer hasn't had much distance from the experience to find it funny. It's not a funny anecdote to the writer yet, because it's only been like, I think Lindsay, you're Lindsay.
Yep. I'm Lindsay.
Lauren Weisberger.
This is where I out myself as Lauren Weisberger.
I would love to, again, I don't know why Sophie Kinsella would rewrite this, but I would like her to.
If you're at a loose end, Sophie.
Yeah.
One thing
one of the few things that was lifted wholesale from the book to the movie and has become iconic, and we have to talk about it, which is the blue sweater scene.
Yes.
I think that is the most fantastic bit of it. I think it is the cool girl speech of writing the stuff about women's jobs, that sort of thing of... It's the only moment where Andy is truly skewered on the sense that, like, oh, you think this is beneath you. And the whole thing of, like, that lumpy blue sweater made its way up from some department. Yeah. Or, hang on, I think I actually have the whole thing here.
I feel like I read something recently, or not that long ago, in, I think it was, like, Vulture. They had an oral history of it or something, and they talked about that scene and how much of it they, how they wrote it and wrote it and wrote it and wrote it and wrote it until it was perfect.
And the way, like, Streep does that as well, where she's, beautiful. Like, she's
styling a model as she's doing it, as though neither job takes any effort or attention to her. She's like, oh, I think we'll add that belt to that outfit. And I think it was Celine who sent Cerulean Blue down the catwalk in this. And she
was
just...
Renta, wasn't it? Yeah.
And she's literally just sat there, dying with soup down her jumper.
And and also that thing between her, like, again, it's just a film thing, but like her and Nigel of, she kind of mid-thing, she turns to him and she goes, Is this a bit, and then he goes, no, I thought the same, but no.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's like this thing of like, oh, they have such a intrinsic chemistry and like they just know each other so well. Those characters have known each other for 20.
And that's something that happens in the book. She quite often, we touched on it a little bit with Emily, but she tries to get other characters on side and everyone is constantly telling her that she's the one that's wrong. You know, even when she gets Emily on side a little bit, Emily even then has to say, but you have to understand what she is extraordinary at what she does.
Yeah.
You want to destroy her for the way she behaves, but that doesn't take away from how she is actually the greatest human in the world that's ever done this. And you can't take that away from her. And she does the same with Nigel. She tries to be like, ugh, Nigel. But he's like, no, you're wrong to treat her the way that you are. You condescend to be here, but realistically, you are lucky. We're not joking. A million girls would kill for this job, and you deign to show up every day. And she never really seems to learn that lesson. Don't think we don't see you.
Exactly. Don't think we don't see you rolling your eyes. Don't you think, you know, like, we get that you're trying hard, but you also, the reason that no one's endeared to you, it's not because of you're a few pounds over our weight. It's because we see you rolling your eyes.
And
we
even
see
Miranda
this.
Says that to her. Even Miranda, right at the end when they're in Paris, says, don't think I don't see the eye rolls, the sighs. You know, I know how you feel, but let me still ask you what it is you want to do. And then still offers to put the call in for her, still offers to help her.
Yeah.
And it's like, yes, she may have been a tyrant. Yes, she may have been a monster, but she actually was going to follow through on what she promised. She actually held up her end of the bargain and your employment contract. You are the one who went in every day saying, ugh, this is beneath me. And yet they were still prepared to help you move on. Everyone else was actually just doing their job, albeit as a monster. You were the one who never got over the fact that you were better than this.
Ooh.
And it's hard. That's a hard lesson to learn, whether you're 22 or 38. Like, it's tough. It's really good. It's hard in the book. It's in the movie, they soften it with, you know, montage and suddenly I see. and Adrian Grenier. But in the book, you're just like, it's a bitter pill.
It is.
That moment when she's in the back of the car with Miranda and Miranda suddenly is like, well, I said I'd help you, so I will help you. And that reading, that
it's
the second
a real
time
honor
around,
among thieves thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's like, oh, she's seen you sneering at her and she's still going to help you because she recognizes talent. And she's going to actually see this through, even though I personally would have fired your ass 6 months ago. But
I mean, the thing is, she does give the 10,000 hours regardless of how she gives them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess this is a lesson for our younger listeners that you don't just have to kill yourself. You also have to smile.
Yeah. So basically, if there's not a smile on your face, which is what I was told, you're doing something wrong.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Lindsay, this has been fantastic.
Has it? I feel so bad.
I'm upset and depressed.
Yay. Yeah. I write rom-coms. Read them.
Yes. So you have many places where we can find you.
Yes.
Tell us about your podcast. Tell us about your books. Tell us about where you're going to be, how we can see it.
I'm all over the place doing anything I shouldn't be doing. Primarily, I guess, my books. I write rom-coms. There's loads of them. I Heart Hawaii is out now, but I had one last year called One in a Million that was a standalone. So if you're not into jumping in a series at the end, One in a Million is a good place to be. You can find me on social media at Lindsay Kelk. I will be there instead of working always. So come say hi. And yeah, I have a beauty podcast called Full Coverage and a pro wrestling podcast called Tights and Fights.
Right.
So yeah, I get around.
You do get around.
Yeah.
So you spend a lot of time with wrestlers.
I've spent some time with wrestlers, yeah.
What's the most surprising thing about wrestling?
They're all really nice.
Wow.
They're all really nice.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.